podcast playlist.
Johnny Cash was on the radio. We stopped for Tim Hortons, and off we went.
And that's the path we're taking on our journey to the future. Hi, I'm Lindsay Michael.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway.
This is Podcast Playlist, the show that introduces you to your new favorite podcast. On today's episode, we're going to celebrate some incredible Canadian podcasters in honor of Canada Day and the 150th anniversary of Confederation.
These podcasts capture what makes Canada diverse and beautiful, with stories from the past and visions for our future. We will hear a story that is a very interesting take on a family vacation when an adventurous filmmaker took his parents to Burning Man.
And we'll flash forward to the future with a podcast that shows us what Canada could look like in the year 2050. Plus, an interview with podcaster and comedian Ryan McMahon of Red Man Laughing. But first up, we'll start with a bang. Firecracker Department is a podcast by comedian Naomi Sneekus.
In each episode, Naomi speaks to successful women in the media and the arts worlds. And in this episode, she's speaking with Bette McDonald. Bette was determined to become an actress without leaving her hometown in Cape Breton. You may know her as Trudy, the secretary in Mr. D. Here's Naomi.
So born in Cape Breton.
Born in Cape Breton, yeah.
And you stayed there.
A hundred years ago, I had a meeting with a manager. And he asked, what do you want from your career? And I said, I want to be a Canadian actor who lives in Cape Breton. And at first, I thought he was going to say, well, sorry, have a nice day. And, but he didn't.
Yes. Yeah.
And I still work with that company.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm working and living in Cape Breton. So
you did
I feel very fortunate. Yeah. It's not like I was shooting the moon here, but I'm very glad that it worked out the way it did.
Yeah. And you haven't suffered for it. Like, your career has been full.
Yeah,
it continues to.
I call my career a compact career because I'm not famous, but I work a lot.
Right. Know? Well, although if you walk around Halifax, we can't go anywhere without somebody going, oh my God, it's Bette McDonald. Oh my God, Miss McDonald, Miss McDonald.
Yeah, what they're probably saying is, she's so much older.
No. No. Oh my God, I'm so starstruck seeing you.
Are you
because
kidding?
You learn how to play the cello with a symphony.
Yes, but that was what I learned. It was very limited. It was very specific. I can play some notes on exactly one song, "To Sir with Love." It's a great song, but still, I won't be joining a symphony anytime soon.
But you're ballsy, right? You just did that. You sang
well,
with a symphony.
Some might call it ballsy. Some might call it irresponsible.
I don't think anybody would call cello playing irresponsible. Like,
well, do you know? The really irresponsible thing was, this makes no sense in the grand scheme of things, but I like the opera. So I decided that I wanted to do this bit where I sing from Don Giovanni, La Ci Darem La Mano, which is this duet where Don Giovanni is seducing this virgin, basically, who's about to be married. And I wanted to do my thing was that the guy playing Don Giovanni doesn't show up. So I have to sing both parts of this
thing.
Great. So I did it.
I love that.
It was hugely fun.
Yeah.
I loved it, but it took me like a year to learn it.
Yeah.
I don't know that people would necessarily see that as time well spent for this little 3-minute piece.
I don't know.
And I've never done it again. I keep thinking, you know, it's like you buy a dress and you think, well, I'll get some wear out of that. This is not a dress that I'm going to get a lot of wear out of.
Until now. Until somebody hears this and be like, we got to get her for that.
Oh, I hope so.
But that's those comedy investments, right? When you see like a shot in a film that obviously costs thousands and thousands of dollars for like one joke. And you're like, if it's for the joke and if it works, it's worth it.
Totally worth it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So then growing up in Cape Breton, have you always been funny? Like, where did you get your funny from?
Well, our family is funny.
Yeah. So your whole family's funny.
They're all funny. And we all agree that the funniest of the siblings, he's not in our business, you know. He's doing something else. But
what's he doing?
He's a lawyer.
That's hilarious.
Hilarious. Yeah. He's a hoot in the courtroom.
Yeah, I bet.
But he, when we were young, and to this day, funny is great currency in our family.
Yeah.
You know? It is. And it's when we get around a table, it's like, you know, bing, bing, bing. It really is.
Yeah.
I sit quietly a lot of the time, to tell you the truth, because they're all so, so funny.
How many siblings?
There are 5 of us all together.
And what about your folks? Were they in the arts at all?
A lot of music in my mother's family.
Yeah.
Not in my father's, but they're all really sharp, funny, you know. Sarcasm is very welcome in our crowd.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
But yeah, and there was a great love of art in the family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then growing up, Cape Breton gal,
yeah.
Was there ever a doubt that you would go into acting? Like, were you ever like, oh, I'm going to choose something else? Or was it always acting?
It was always that.
Wow.
When we were little kids, I was extremely lucky. When we were little single digits, I used to force my friends to take part in shows.
Just like now with the cabarets.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But I was Florence Ziegfeld, you know, and I would make the whole show happen, and then I would, now that when I think back on it, I think, what a horrible child, but I would get the other, you know, give the other, my friends, lesser roles.
Right.
And then away we're going, you know, my mother, I have a clear image of my mother and other women in the neighborhood standing in the basement watching this show, which I'm sure was fabulous. And, you know, they've got 600 other things that they should be doing, but they're standing there. Yeah, that's excellent, girls.
Move it along, girls. Move it along. Yeah. An hour
later.
Yeah. So you produce these. You were a producer from the early age.
I was a producer, yes. Yeah.
And so when you were in high school, were you like the lead all the time and everything?
No, I was too shy.
Really?
Here's how crazy this is. Stupid, really, I suppose it is.
There's so many performers that are shy.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't know. I'm shocked.
It's just one of nature's cruel jokes. But I was... my mother, by the way, always said... there was never, no, you should do something sensible. My father did say that. He wanted me to be a nurse. And I'm thinking... Now, like, you should thank your lucky stars, Cape Breton, that did.
That's Firecracker Department, hosted by Naomi Sneekus. For more, visit cbc.ca/podcast playlist. And on today's show, Canadian podcasts in honor of Canada 150. This next story pitches an idea that I think a lot of us would probably be horrified by. Have you ever experienced that moment, Lindsay, when you see your parents out of context? I mean, you know your parents and you know who they are and the lives that they lead, but suddenly you kind of see them in an environment that you could never possibly imagine them in?
I think mostly when I think about my parents as young people, before I was around, it's like that. Like I found this picture of my dad, and he has a pet crow. Like he was a biologist, and he found a crow that had, like, it was sick or had a broken wing, and he like raised it and then just had this pet crow that followed him around.
The man behind this next story ended up in a very interesting environment with his very conservative parents. He decided to take his parents to Burning Man.
That's like, I feel like of all the places I would take my parents, Burning Man would not be the first one.
Burning Man is kind of like a no holds barred art festival. It takes place every year in the Nevada desert. You can't spend money. You have to trade things.
Right.
They build this giant thing and then they burn it at the end. Here's the Vancouver-based podcast, The Lapse, and host Kyle Guest with more.
I thought Burning Man was like the most hardcore thing out there. Sex, drugs, burning false idols in the desert.
In reality,
it is a festival that's built on participation. There's no money exchanged there. It's an economy based around gifting. It's really hard to explain to people, and everyone gets something different out of it. Some people are like, yeah, it's the best party ever. They sleep all day and just rave hard every night. Then there's people who are like, it's the greatest art expression ever, and they're in that scene. People will be like, it's the greatest place to go have orgies.
In short, this city springs up out of the Nevada desert, and at the end of the festival, they burn it.
You know, we were just out of film school. We had no money.
And then I heard about this whole crowdfunding thing.
The boys raise a staggering $10,000 on Kickstarter.
In order to make this happen, we just...
I had maxed out 2 of my credit cards getting everything ready for the desert.
With you, we can make this happen.
And then lose all of it to what Kickstarter later calls an administrative glitch.
My friend that was lending us an RV informs me that it's not ready to go. There was 40 hours of work to put into it. Try booking an RV a week before Burning Man. I'm all about like trust the universe. Like, we can figure it out. No matter what, Burning Man's going to be there. We're going to find a ride down.
No, trust the universe. It'll all work out as it should.
My parents are all like, cut the You can't just trust the universe. We have to go to Burning Man in 3 days and we don't know how we're getting down there.
The word hope is my least favorite word in the English dictionary. If hope is what drives you, you're not driven. You're just waiting for some magic to happen. 2 nights before we go to leave to Burning Man, it's this Australian guy whose name's Henry. He bought a 40-foot school bus. This green, old 40-foot school bus that goes a maximum of 40 miles an hour and runs on propane. I didn't even know vehicles could run on propane.
Why, mate?
Henry says.
Do you need a ride down for your film crew and your parents?
Joel hesitates.
Do you know anything about buses?
Oh, yeah, mate. Know how to drive them? Know how to party in them? What else do you need to know?
Heck yes! This is it!
Parents in tow and their credit cards maxed, the crew hits the road. The deal with Henry means that 15 other first-time burners are also on the bus.
He's kind of like Otto from The Simpsons, and Otto wasn't chill but obnoxious.
Joel's already got his producer's cap on. He points at a cameraman.
Why don't we play a game of I Never with the parents and the whole bus?
Brian's dad poses the next I've Never. I've never been in a menage a trois. Several burners, including his son, take a drink. And then from the front of the bus.
You got me.
He takes a drink from his beer, except that it's their driver, Henry.
How does this person even exist?
At 40 miles an hour, the 800-mile trip ain't exactly rushing by.
We want to get to Burning Man today. If we stop for gas, it becomes an hour just because, like, oh, two people want to go smoke. And then at the very end, two more people are like, oh, wait, we want to smoke. And then the people that had the first smoke is like, oh, well, if you're smoking, I'll start a smoke. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm going to go crazy.
Meanwhile, Brian just kicks back. Burning Man starts, and they're still not there. He feels a hand on his shoulder. It's Brian's dad, Charles.
You know what?
Charles says.
I realize we don't have a plan. As long as I know that, and that there is no plan, we can never not be on time. And he just kind of chilled out, and that kind of chilled me out, too.
We arrive, like, in the middle of the night, pretty much. It's totally dark.
30 hours later than we planned?
And there's nowhere to camp.
We thought we had this space put aside for us, but I guess it was too small of a space for what we actually had.
They stumble across the Black Rock Desert for an hour, trying to find somewhere to settle.
You've never experienced a drier dry in your life. This is a place that physically cannot sustain life. The only sign of life I saw in the week I was there, I saw a tumbleweed rolling in the distance. And I was like, oh my god, life can sustain here? Where are these tumbleweeds growing? It is a place that, like, you just go to die.
Finally, there's a spot where nobody's hunkered down. The camp next door is enormous, housing nearly 150 burners. Bryant opens up the big tent's flap and marches inside, Joel in tow. Dozens of people in their 40s, 50s, and even 60s sit inside, but nobody pays the kids much mind.
Brian's like, hey, you know, we're shooting this documentary. We thought we had a place to camp. Turns out we didn't.
A handlebar mustache points a finger at Brian.
I saw you on Kickstarter.
Turns out a lot of people know this camp.
Tuna camp. It's a group of like 60-year-old tuna fishermen, 150 people in this camp.
That bring down pounds upon pounds of tuna in a refrigerated truck, and they serve it to the client. They just like give it away.
Their theme camp owner died that year trying to save the people on his ship.
They're not at all like the stereotypes Brian's parents are expecting. With camp settled and the sun rising, filming can start. But Brian wants one quick adventure before business.
No, guys, we need to go out and do this much.
Joel taps his timepiece.
Probably the only person at Burning Man wearing a watch.
Just a half hour, he says. And Brian disappears into the crowd.
And it's like telling the kids at Disneyland, like, don't go off and play on whatever rides you want. Like, let's go as a group.
Joel spends his time getting to know the place with Lee and Charles, Brian's mom and dad. Everywhere they look, there's something new to see.
Oh, there's titty painting, there's a math lecture, they're playing the Big Lebowski, this is great!
On the other end of Burning Man, Brian and his friends skip from one exhibit to the next.
A geodome that you could drop down 20 feet into like a foam pit.
Flamethrowers, ships on wheels, marionettes, and more. They're in the middle of a tennis match when Joel finally finds them.
Are you kidding me? Do you know how long you guys were? And we're like, I don't know, like 45 minutes?
I kind of had to be bad cop. We have to shoot a feature film, right?
He's like, 2.5 hours. How are you going to make a movie without a watch? I'm like, how are you going to experience Burning Man with a watch on?
Over the next few days, they try and work out a balance. Brian will stick to his schedule. Joel will loosen up a little.
I had a few nights off. Most of them I ended up partying with Henry.
On the other end of the desert, Brian's parents are exploring. Lee turns to Charles.
Oh, I should have brought a snack. Hungry, and they're in the middle of the desert.
Before she says anything else, something buzzes past her leg. It's a remote-controlled dump truck full of chips and dip. It's like someone read her mind.
Are you kidding me? They look around for who's driving it and they can't even see.
Lee takes a bite and backs up a step. The dump truck mirrors her movements.
You think of something, it pops up in front of you, and I wasn't sure if my parents would experience this. Playa magic.
As the days pass, that same feeling, that sense of wonder, seems like it's around every corner. Joel and Charles tour the art installations in the big playa area, and he suddenly just gets it.
These humongous installations, this amazing engineering, and he was just blown away. Oh my gosh, this is what it's about?
The piece de resistance.
We walked into this pirate ship, and he was just like, oh my gosh, like look at this table. Look at like the little intricate details of this. This giant pirate ship, like to scale, and all the set deck inside was like period accurate. We looked at every detail, and we're just like, there's so much love that went into this.
On the second last day, the eponymous Burning Man set ablaze.
That night is crazy.
My gosh, it was like the hottest thing ever. There's explosions that happen, and like the heat from the fire was so intense, like I thought my camera was gonna melt, and I thought my face was gonna melt.
But despite the name, that's not really the end of Burning Man.
Everyone thinks that it ends after that, but the day after that, they burn the temple. For Lee, Brian's mom, right before we left on the trip, like a couple months before, her mom passed away for basically no reason. She was healthy. She needed a standard operation. And something went wrong in that operation. And she died. And it was just like out of the blue. At Burning Man, there's this temple.
It's almost like a giant memorial without any sort of religious denomination or anything like that.
And you write like something for a loved one who's passed away or something that you want to change in your life. At the end of the week, they burn it down, and it's like this release of grief, usually, for most people, is what it's become.
The whole family is at the temple. Lee writes her mother's name on the wall.
The whole family hugged and held each other, and I'm bawling behind the camera. Like, I've never been in an energy where you walk into a room, and the energy is so intense that you just start bawling. I'm not a spiritual person by nature. I could not even like look through my lens very well because I was crying so hard.
That night the temple burns, but this time there's no revelry, only whispers like the gusts of desert wind. And as the flame is being lit, a chorus rises. A choir sings this beautiful rendition of Ave Maria. The temple is engulfed, and Burning Man comes to an end. With a little word of mouth, the crew re-raises the money they need for the film. 2 years later, they have a movie.
Anytime you've like done something massive or made something massive and it comes to a close, it's this weird impact, this weird like afterglow that you have.
Bryant swears he'll attend Burning Man every year for as long as he possibly can. And Joel?
I'm going to Burning Man with my parents this summer. I didn't really realize what I signed up for. Having to edit this project, looking at Burning Man all the time, and it being so much a part of my life, I have to go back.
As for Brian's parents,
Charles definitely wants to go back to Burning Man. He wants to build an art car and get right into it. Lee has stated that she had fun with it and doesn't think that she needs to go back to Burning Man and is totally okay if she never does, but she wouldn't let Charles go alone. He felt like he was out of touch with young people before this, but like he was thrown into it. It was like seeing this guy go become a kid again. And I think that's the magic of Burning Man. Like, you know, when you're in a big rainstorm and you're like waiting under a little piece of shelter. I think of the times I was hiding under a shade structure with a stranger and just sparking up a conversation because the dust storms were so heavy. this movie is a staple in time that we'll always have. Regardless of if it's super successful or super not, I owe that all to Bryant's can-do attitude of saying, like, let's do this now. Sometimes you just got to dive into the deep end.
From the podcast The Lapse, that was Taking My Parents to Burning Man. It's hosted and produced by Kyle Guest. This is Podcast Playlist Today. It's our all-Canadian show in honor of Canada's 150. But not everybody will be celebrating Canada 150 this year. In the face of this year's celebration of Canadian history, how do we reconcile with the history experienced by Indigenous peoples?
Red Man Laughing is a podcast by Anishinaabe comedian and podcaster Ryan McMahon, who Lindsay will be speaking with coming up a bit later on in the program. But first, the fifth season of Red Man Laughing was dedicated to exploring this very topic of reconciliation. It is incredible. This episode is all about land.
So, land and reconciliation. There's a couple of different things that I'd like to present here. Like, how do we, as Anishinaabe people, stewards of the land, reconcile with the damage that is on the land? How can I, in Treaty 3, reconcile with the fact that most of Treaty 3 is clear-cut? The forestry industry has deep roots inside of Treaty 3. Over 100 years ago, forestry started. Pulp and paper mills popped up in small towns all across northwestern Ontario. And the clear-cutting went on for 100 years. When you fly over Treaty 3, a lot of it looks like a desert. It's shocking. How do I reconcile that? How do I, as an Anishinaabe person, accept responsibility and go out and try to protect that land, to heal it, to ensure this never happens again? That is a form of reconciliation. How do we hold those chiefs, those decision makers, those leaders that are responsible for letting industry into our communities, how do we hold them accountable for said violence on the land? As we've talked about in earlier episodes of this podcast during this season, violence on the land equals violence in our communities. The man camps, the industry, it all equals violence against those most vulnerable. Generally, our women, our youth, and our Two-Spirit community. So, how do we hold those leaders responsible? Do we? Is that fair? We're a desperate people. We're a poor people. We're a colonized people. So we get confused. When the carrots are dangled in front of our face and we're hungry, we need to eat. I was in Toronto in 2011. I came out of a show at the convention center down near the world's largest eagle staff, the CN Tower. And I came out, and much to my surprise, there was a very, very large protest happening. I noticed the signs that were being carried. A lot of them were pro-Indigenous signs. And I could see that this was mostly a white audience. And that's okay. Don't get mad. I said white. Just it was mostly white people. And that's okay. If you're white, just be white. Not too white. Just white enough. Anyway, a lot of white people protest. I asked a gentleman who was standing near me where they were headed. He said, down to shut down Bay Street. Are you coming with? And I thought, why not? My hotel's that way anyway. And we walked. And I listened. And I learned that this protest was in an effort to draw attention to the connection between mining, oil, the banks, and basically the world mafia. They wanted to shut down Bay Street to let the world know that there are crooks amongst us. Sounded good to me. So I walked. I got down to where, roughly where my hotel was, and I had enough of the hippy-dippy talk. Sorry, white folks. And I peaced out, and I went to my hotel. The next day, I caught a flight out to Edmonton, Alberta. I was doing a show up near Frog Lake, Alberta. Of course, an oil-rich Indigenous community. Cree, specifically. Most of the time, when I do shows, I rent my own vehicle. I'm very independent. I want to stay out of people's hair and not be too much of a bother. but for whatever reason this time, they arranged to have me driven up to Frog Lake from Edmonton. Three older gentlemen picked me up at the Edmonton airport. Three Cree guys. So it was cool. Johnny Cash was on the radio. We stopped for Tim Hortons, and off we went on the close to 3-hour drive to Frog Lake. And we started to talk. And we talked. And we talked. I listened a lot. And then I decided I wanted to let them know that just one night earlier, I was in Toronto protesting their community. Protesting everything their community stood for. Protesting tar sands production. Oil. Here in Canada. They laughed. Nervously, I think. Maybe to just let me know everything was going to be okay. But then they talked. And I listened. One gentleman told me about how he had held out for a long time from working out in the oil sands. He, like many others, were against it at first. But over time, he wasn't able to hold out anymore. He watched people around him get rich. Well, relatively so. And people started to buy vehicles, fix up their houses. They had things. He had nothing. Then he started a family, and he still had nothing. He didn't feel like it was fair that his kids were growing up in abject poverty with nothing, while the other kids in the community had something. So he caved, and he started working in the oil sands. He's been working in the oil sands for 18 years. He's got a pension. Everything's good. Everything, in his words, is perfect. As perfect as it can be. The second gentleman in the truck told me that he, like the others, had held out for a while, but his daughter was sick, and he decided that he needed to take the job because he needed to go to Calgary for specialist appointments with his daughter. He couldn't afford to do it. The band wasn't paying all of the expenses it took to get her down there twice a month, and he needed the money. And since starting that job just 6 years ago, he has changed the health and well-being of his daughter by seeing the specialists. The treatments that she receives works, takes care of her MS, and by all accounts, she's going to live a full, happy, and healthy life. There's no arguing with that. I can't tell that man that he sold out for working in the oil sands when he arguably saved his daughter's life. The third story that I heard in the truck was from the old man. He was the oldest of the three and certainly the wisest. He talked slowly. He wasn't sure what he wanted to say. As he said, "I don't know what to tell you about the tar sands or about what we do up here in Frog Lake, but I can tell you this. I used to be able to hunt in my backyard. I would go out in a four-wheeler and shoot whatever I saw, and I'd eat it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Those days are over," he said. Imagine that. Not being able to eat the moose. Not being able to eat the deer. Not being able to eat the birds or the fish. Traveling 6, 7, 8, 10 hours to get to where the animals aren't sick. But since all of these jobs came to Frog Lake, he said, he's noticed a difference in the community. He's noticed a pride. He's noticed the change. People have things. Cars, houses. They're more well off than other communities in the territory. And that's what the people chose, he said. They chose to go this way. It's too late to go back, he said.
That was Red Man Laughing by Ryan McMahon from the Indian and Cowboy Network. I'll be speaking with Ryan McMahon later on in the show. This is Podcast Playlist, and today we're sharing 100% Canadian podcasts. And if you have a favorite Canadian podcast, we would love to hear about it. You can tweet us at Podcast Playlist or email podcastplaylist@cbc.ca.
Next up, a podcast that explores what Canada's future could hold in the wake of climate change.
In a new CBC podcast, 2050 Degrees of Change, meteorologist Joanna Wagstaff transports us to the year 2050, where decisions from the past have a huge impact on our environmental future.
Here's what you need to know. In 2050, BC is much, much warmer than you've known it to be.
We're looking at still about 2.5 degrees of warming for the province as a whole. Now, keep in mind that's when you're averaging over the whole province, there's going to be some important regional differences. So for Vancouver and Victoria, we're looking at about 2.5 degrees as well. But there may be larger increases in the interior, in some parts of the north. The variability in some places is more than others. So, you know, 2.5 degrees of warming on the coast may actually be more like a bigger change relative to historical variability than even a larger change like 3 or 4 degrees somewhere else in the province.
That's Trevor Murdoch. He works with the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium at the University of Victoria. He's an expert on regional climate change in the province. He takes all of the research from the IPCC and zooms in on what that global data means for different parts of BC in the future. You probably recognize that acronym. The IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a UN body made up of thousands of scientists and policymakers who gather the most up-to-date research. The IPCC and Trevor work with different climate scenarios that try to map out how we, as humans, will act in the future, how much greenhouse gas we'll keep pumping into the atmosphere, and what that will mean for global temperatures. There are the worst-case scenarios, where we continue down the path we're on now or make very little progress. That's the catastrophic climate change by the end of the century road. Then there's the best case scenario, what the Paris Accord is hoping to achieve, where the global rise in temperature is kept well below 2 degrees. And then we have a scenario in the middle, and that's the path we're taking on our journey to the future. It's an optimistic one, which takes a lot of hard work. It imagines that by 2050, we've cut our carbon emissions globally by half and are on track to keeping that number stable. All of the science you hear in this podcast is based on this scenario. The experts call it RCP 4.5. And that's what Trevor's referencing when he says BC is looking at an average temperature rise of 2.5 degrees in just 33 years.
Sometimes it's hard to really get across the scale of change we're talking about. It's hard to even really wrap your mind around it because a couple of degrees doesn't sound like a big deal. But when you average over an entire year, it takes a lot to even make a degree of difference because of how noisy weather is. So, you know, you can imagine if you had a year where every single day was normal, but you had 10 degrees above normal for 30 days in a row, that'd be a really big deal. It'd be a super long heat wave. But that year would actually only be about a degree warmer than normal, just because all the other normal days average it out. If you imagine warming by a couple of degrees, you're talking about a climate where these new cold years that in the middle of the century, the year that's so cold it causes some kind of impacts on the landscape because it's so abnormal, that's actually warmer than the warm years that we've had in the past. Those are warmer than the 2003s and the 2015s and 16s. And then the normals are warmer than that, and the extreme warm years are even warmer than that. So on the one hand, a couple degrees doesn't sound like a big deal. On the other hand, we're talking about like a completely different place.
A completely different place. 2010, 2014, 2015, 2016. Up until now, those were some of the hottest years on record. And that will be the new normal. In 2050, Vancouver sees more than double the number of days above 25 degrees than it did in the 20-teens. Now, that might sound appealing to some of you, and it means a longer growing season, but it also means more frequent heat waves, a higher risk of forest fires, and more extreme weather more often. Our seasons play out differently, too. Warmer, wetter winters across the province means a massive drop in the snowpack year after year, which means we think differently about our once seemingly limitless freshwater supply. And of course, hitting the slopes becomes a rare luxury. Spring melts come earlier. The dry season lasts longer. Our wettest days are much wetter. Now here's the thing. A 2.5 degree rise in temperature doesn't mean everything is just that much hotter. As the ocean warms, more moisture evaporates into the atmosphere. This extra moisture in the air makes it more likely storms will bring downpours and flooding risks. Changes in ocean surface temperature affect currents and atmospheric circulation, meaning more extremes on both sides of the coin. Droughts and more intense rainy seasons. Brutal one-off snowstorms. Possibly more fuel for hurricanes and tornadoes. As the ocean and Earth's surface heat at different rates, changes are already happening to our jet streams. Those giant conveyor belts that move our weather along, they're stalling out, getting stuck for way longer than they used to. In fact, recent studies show the frequency of jet streams stalling out has increased by 70% since the Industrial Revolution. All of this is why we say climate change will lead to more intense, extreme weather events. Not to mention bumpier flights with more turbulence.
Anywhere from 20 to over 100 millimeters of rain. Higher amounts are...
You know those atmospheric rivers some meteorologist is always going on about? Like the Pineapple Express that funnels subtropical downpours and heat into the West Coast like a fire hose. In 2050, they're common and more severe. More damaging windstorms fueled by those warmer waters. Eastern Pacific typhoons that last a little longer on their track east from Asia. There will always be variability in our weather and our climate. And before we go any further, I should point out that these are very different concepts. Weather is atmospheric conditions that happen over a short period of time, hours, days, weeks. But climate is how the atmosphere behaves over relatively long periods of time, months, years, decades. Some years will be hotter, some colder. Large-scale oscillations in the sun cycles, ocean temperatures, and trade winds like El Niño or La Niña will add to the extremes. But as I watch and report on the impacts of individual weather events in a world where the population is growing at an exponential rate, where more and more people are affected by everything that comes with a warmer climate, it's vital to make that link. Because as the climate baseline heats up, it impacts every weather event. It's like storms on steroids.
That was the CBC original podcast 2050 Degrees of Change. It's hosted by Joanna Wagstaff. This is Podcast Playlist, today celebrating Canadian content.
Earlier in the show, we shared an excerpt from Red Man Laughing, hosted by Ryan McMahon. And in addition to hosting Red Man Laughing and Stories from the Land and being a host of Canada Land Commons, he's the founder of the Indian and Cowboy Podcast Network, along with a million other projects. He's a very busy guy. And Ryan McMahon joins me now in studio in Toronto. Hi.
Hi.
So nice to meet you in person and not in just on Twitter.
Retweeting each other.
That's
and
right.
Faving, liking. Yeah.
All the things.
It's nice to be here.
So how, for someone who hasn't heard of it, how would you describe the Indian and Cowboy Podcast Network?
So Indian and Cowboy is simply an Indigenous podcast network. We're member supported. So our listeners are the ones that pay our bills. And we have a diverse lineup of shows. So there's a little bit of something, I won't say for everyone, but for those that are curious about Indigenous stories, we have something called Métis in Space, which is two phenomenal Indigenous women drinking a bottle of wine, watching a piece of sci-fi, and then tearing it apart from a decolonial feminist lens, which is
hilarious.
If you were to pitch that anywhere else, people would go, I don't know. And then we have, you know, sort of more serious offerings like Stories from the Land, which we're talking about connecting decolonization and land through Indigenous storytelling. This launched now July 1st. We are opening up our premium content portal. So there's a little bit of something for everyone there.
Do you think podcasting as a medium offers any special opportunities to Indigenous media creators?
Wow. I think 100%. I mean, the barrier to entry inside of the Canadian film and television industry is, I mean, insurmountable. Hmm. So podcasting, you know, that first podcast I told you about, that was an $11 USB mic I bought at Walmart. You know, this is the great reward of anyone that takes the risk of podcasting.
Right.
Is you really discover, you know, your voice, what is important to you, the creativity that it offers, but also the rewards of the community you build. And so I'm sitting here with you because we're in the same space. And podcasting generally is a very supportive community. We all care deeply about the stories that we're telling. And for most of us that are doing it off the side of our desk and as a labor of love, there's something really beautiful and special about that too.
Well, I want to ask you about your podcast for a second. So you don't just run this network. You also participate in a few podcasts and you're in your sixth season of Red Man Laughing. How has your vision of the show evolved since you started?
I mean, it's Red Man Laughing. So it started as a comedy
right.
podcast. And it's anything but right now.
Yeah, it's moved a different direction.
Very different. And thank you, Adam Lamore. You know, thanks a lot. That's what happened.
And yeah.
I had, you know, at that time, thousands of listeners every week that were tuning into Red Man Laughing. And then this thing called Idle No More happens. And suddenly, you know, fart jokes aren't so funny. And,
right.
And I have this space. So I started inviting people onto the podcast to have conversations about the politics and what was happening. And the internet erupted. Their listeners came in droves, and people needed a place to turn.
Why did you decide to dedicate your entire fifth season to reconciliation?
Because the mainstream discourse and what we were seeing in mainstream media was sort of representing one story. And the story that was being told through mainstream media wasn't a story that I could really connect to. And it wasn't a story that I thought was necessarily true. And so I thought and I complained about it. I railed on how we were sort of tiptoeing around some of the really difficult truths.
Right.
And felt like, okay, if we are going to be serious about reconciliation, then a couple things need to be true. We need to center Indigenous voices. Mm-hmm. Those are the voices we need to hear. And we have to figure out a way to get past being triggered by the 150 years in this country and the words, right? Treaties. Colonization. These are words that when Canadians hear them, they just induce just epic eye rolls, right? These are the realities of Indigenous people in Canada today, is that we talk about this stuff all the time because we have to live it.
Right.
And the benefit of Canadians, you know, the way they've benefited over the last 150 years here in this country is they haven't had to live it. They just get to benefit off it. They
right.
just get to live their lives in this beautiful, safe, well-to-do country. And so I decided that if I was going to complain about it, that I had to do something about it. And so the entire fifth season of the podcast was an exploration of in real time, because, the TRC finished their final report and I was there. And so the podcast, that season of the podcast brings you behind sort of the start of my journey,
mm-hmm.
where I did a piece for the 180,
yeah,
and Jim Brown, and I said a lot of bad words that they couldn't air. I was so angry,
yeah,
and basically said to Canada, keep your reconciliation because I don't want it. And I thought that, and for me, that was sort of bottom, right? If I could put it that way,
mm-hmm.
I thought, boy, that's really angry. So that's where the first episode of that season starts, and you can see the trajectory.
Where did you end up by the end of the season?
Telling people that we need more love.
Wow, that's a huge turn.
I could cry thinking about it. Like it is a real journey, because being in communities and talking about reconciliation, these are in a lot of ways people that I look up to, people that I respect, residential school survivors, youth, and people whose lives are on the line. Like when we talk about reconciliation and Canada 150, people's lives are actually on the line. We're talking about clean drinking water. We're talking about dead Indigenous women. We're talking about young people that are incarcerated four times the national average. I mean, all the statistics paint this picture. And so doing that season in real time, if you listen to it, you'll experience that journey and going through that journey to identify, oh yeah, no, there are answers. Indigenous people have answers. They've always had answers on how to move forward. We've never centered those voices. And by the end of it, it was clear that, you know, time and time again, residential school survivors themselves told me, love, you have to love, you have to show love. And at the end of the day, what was targeted were our families. And what happened? Well, we fell out of love with ourselves, with each other, with our communities. And so to rebuild our communities, it will take a profound act of love and courage. And that's where the end of the season kind of brings you to, is that place where it's going to take courage. We started to coin a phrase, strong hearts to the front. We need all the strong hearts to the front of the line to do this work. And I think that's where we are today. You know, people, Indigenous people right now are resisting Canada 150. I don't know anyone that's going to listen to Sarah McLachlan's sad songs in Ottawa. But we found a way to create our own celebration around the act of resistance that our ancestors have had to live over the last 150 years. So what we're doing through Indian and Cowboy, what we're doing through our digital media offerings is we are informed by what is behind us, but mm-hmm. we're not living there anymore. And my promise or my offer is that the space that we are creating through digital media will be a space that is informed by the past, but brings us forward. And so if we can do that through podcasting or anything else we do on the platform, then we'll have done our job.
Ryan McMahon, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Ryan McMahon is the founder of the Indian and Cowboy Podcast Network. He joined me in studio in Toronto.
Here in Canada, a new face is joining our currency. The $10 bill will feature Viola Desmond. It makes its debut in 2018.
Viola Desmond became a civil rights icon after she was physically removed from a segregated movie theater for sitting in the whites-only section. Here's Today in Canadian History with that story.
Graham Reynolds is a professor of history and the Viola Desmond Chair in Social Justice at Cape Breton University in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I reached him there.
Viola had a little bit of problem seeing in distance, so she was a little bit short-sighted, so she decided to sit downstairs close to the screen. And shortly after she sat down, the usher came and told her that she had to sit upstairs. And Viola said, "No, I'm comfortable here. Thank you very much." And he insisted that she didn't have the ticket for downstairs. She had purchased a ticket for upstairs. So Viola went to the cashier where she picked up her ticket, and she explained that she had to sit downstairs. And the cashier said, "No, you have to sit upstairs. The upstairs is for people of your kind." And I think she got the sense then that there was a problem in terms of racial segregation. Viola decided to go back into the theater, and she proceeded to sit down once again downstairs. A short while later, the manager came and told her that she had to sit upstairs. She couldn't sit downstairs. And Viola then was, at this point, insistent that she was not moving. She was going to sit downstairs. So the manager, Mr. Harry McNeil, went outside and flagged down a local police officer. And they both together went into the theater and forcefully, physically removed Viola, placed her in a local cab, and took her to the local police station, where she was placed under arrest and kept in prison till the next day, a full 12 hours. The next day, she was brought before a judge. And the judge determined that she was guilty of defrauding the province of a 1 cent amusement park tax that she didn't pay, because there was a difference between the price of the upstairs ticket from the downstairs ticket. The upstairs ticket was 30 cents, and the downstairs ticket was 40 cents. So Viola was guilty, according to the judge, of not paying the difference in tax between the upstairs ticket and the downstairs ticket, which was a full 1 cent. So she was found guilty, and then was given a sentence of $20 plus the court costs, or to serve 30 days in jail. So Viola then paid the fine and then made her way back home. And, of course, she was absolutely totally devastated by this. She was physically roughed up, bruised, and, of course, totally in shock by the experience. We speculate on why she wanted to resist the situation that she found herself in New Glasgow, and I think my reading of this is that she basically in a spontaneous kind of reaction said to herself, "This is wrong. I shouldn't be forced to sit in the balcony. I deserve, as everyone else, is to sit where I feel comfortable. And I think that she just very much took an immediate profound reaction to the situation she found herself in. And that, I think, reflects the kind of character that she had. And I think that her whole life was very much making decisions and being responsible and standing up for what she felt was right.
Viola wasn't alone. Her family, friends, and prominent members of the Black community in Halifax offered their support and mounted an appeal. The case ultimately went all the way to the Supreme Court.
And at the end of the day, Viola lost the case in the Supreme Court. And the initial verdict was upheld. And, of course, I think there was tremendous disappointment throughout the Black community in Nova Scotia. But I think this is very typical of the kind of situation that was very much present through most of Canada at this time, a pattern of discrimination and of segregation, really, very much in a sense like the pattern of discrimination in the United States as far as what was called the Jim Crow laws. I think the big difference in Canada at this time was the fact that the laws were not on the books in support of Jim Crow, but there were no laws that prohibited the enforcement of segregation. I think it did. It's taken almost 65 years, but I think immediately there was a very strong reaction, and there was a number of there were articles in the local papers, and there was a Black newspaper in Nova Scotia, the Clarion, that carried the issue and supported the case and drew support for Viola. But, you know, as I said before, I think that that over time, this issue kind of receded into the recesses of our collective memory, and it sort of became, you know, less of an issue. And I think that that's that's part of the story, and that's why it's so important for us to keep in mind the full sort of context of this in terms of the ultimate sort of recognition of the process of discrimination and segregation in Nova Scotia. That ultimately led the government of Nova Scotia last spring in April to issue a unprecedented free pardon to Viola. But the free pardon, which is really a mercy free pardon, is something which does not acknowledge original guilt. And in this case, it says that there was a wrong that was no fault of Viola. And she doesn't deserve mercy. It's really the law that was wrong. It was the actual case itself. And so as a result of this, Viola's record is clean as far as she's not guilty of anything, because she never was guilty. And the record stands as far as the court records for her being charged. So we can keep it as a source of historical research and information to acknowledge Viola now as being a symbol of the struggle for racial equality is, I think, very important for all Canadians.
Today in Canadian History is created by Mark Affeld and Joe Burima.
And that's it for us for today.
We are so excited to announce the launch of our Canadian podcast database, months in the making.
A database of hundreds of Canadian podcasts from all across this country, still a work in progress. We will be adding to it as we find out more about new podcasts and podcasts that we didn't know about. But you can find it as it exists right now at cbc.ca/podcast playlist. Now you can listen to Podcast Playlist and all of the full excerpts every week on the Radio Public mobile app. Each week we put together a playlist in that app that includes the episode you're listening to right now, as well as each of the episodes we have excerpted here. You can listen to them all in one go. You'll find that Radio Public app on our website, at Google Play, or at the App Store.
The podcast playlist team is Allison Broverman, Kate Evans, Phil Lung, Anne Lang, Amelia Scher, and Arif Noorani. I'm Lindsay Michael.
I'm Matt Dalloway. We'll talk again soon.